Are you employed, Mr. Lebowski?
Wait, let me explain something to you. I am not Mr. Lebowski. You're Mr. Lebowski. I'm the dude. So that's what you call me, you know? That or his dudeness or duder or, you know, El Duderino, if you're not into the whole brevity thing.
Hi, I'm Sophie, and I haven't seen a lot of movies.
Hi, I'm Paul, and I'm here to help with that. And we are...
SP Film Viewers.
Hey, dude.
I'm not your dude.
Dudette.
No one called dude.
No.
You think you're a surfer?
No, I think I'm making reference to the film that we're going to be talking about. Pretty popular film with many people. Is comedy.
Right. When you say popular people, do you mean the people that I don't appreciate popular wise for a comedy?
Popular with the general audience or people who are actors who are, well... Yeah, we've got one of the people, Steve Buscemi, who...
Isn't he from Monty Python? No?
Monty Python?
Oh, no, never mind, yeah. I know who he is. I can't remember what he's from now, but I know.
Reservoir Dogs.
Mr. Pink?
Yeah.
Okay, what is the film
anyway,
about? Come on, tell me, because I have no clue what this is.
So, a cult classic, and it's called The Big Lebowski.
You keep saying this to me, but I don't mean Jack. Like, what is the Big Lebowski? What does Lebowski?
That's the name of
mean?
One of the people,
right?
But
last name.
It's a last name.
Oh, thank God. Do they refer to him?
Well, no, they refer to him as the dude.
Okay, that's easy. At least I can do that one.
Yeah,
Don't have to say the Lebowski again.
Mike Wazowski. But the basic premise is when the dude, Lebowski, is mistaken for a millionaire Lebowski, two thugs urinate on his rug.
Oh, wonderful.
To coerce him into paying a debt he knows nothing about.
I feel like I'll just get a new rug. Thanks. You can take that with you now when you piss on
it. Like, I want to say the quote, but I can't say it'll make more sense when you watch the film.
He really sold that to me. Can't wait.
It's like a crime comedy as well, so it's a bit more like a bit like Fargo was, and it's the same people who worked on it. So
you're pulling it up a bit.
Yeah, okay.
How long?
This is 2 hours.
Okay, that's bearable. My other question.
Yeah.
What defines a dude?
Huh?
What is a dude?
Someone who's like cool and chill, I guess.
Is that Wikipedia definition there, Paul?
Might be an Urban Dictionary definition, but...
I don't know. Do I sound weird when I say the word dude?
It just, typed it into the search and it says it's a noun and it's a man, a guy, often as a form of address. Like, hey, dude, what's up?
But what makes you be a dude? Definitely cool to be a dude.
Well, that's what I just said. And has a distinctive... whiff of American West Coast hippie culture to it, so it's obviously started with the American persuasion.
You get called dude and you're not hippie and you're not American.
No, but it's just like a chill, easy, hey man or whatever.
I hate that.
Well, you're right there, you're not a man, are you? So,
thank God.
And two other things. One, this is one we've got a special guest with us for this episode. So, once we've seen the film.
Oh, no. What if I hate it? You always do it on the ones that I'm going to hate. And then I don't. And then I'm like, they come with valid points. And then I'm like, oh, maybe I'm being a bit harsh. Did they pick this?
Yes.
Okay.
One of their favourites. So.
Oh, no. See, don't say that. Don't say that. Because now the pressure's on.
Well, it's to get a female's perspective on it. So.
What are you trying to say? I'm not a female.
No, I said that you are a female.
Is it the guest a male?
Yes.
Oh, sorry, right. I thought you meant there was another female perspective on it, not just mine.
And so, the fact, again, unintentional, now the other film we've covered were 1997. This is 1998, but that's not my fault, because obviously that's the film we picked. So I feel like next time, the next episode, will have to be a 1998 film to pick from.
Good luck you finding that.
Yeah, that we neither of us have seen, so that'll be a challenge.
Yeah.
I'll have to look into that. But anyway, that's by the by.
So, nice happy surprise, I guess.
Right, so we'll be back with our special guest, of course, on what Sophie thought of The Big Lebowski.
Can't it just be called Big Dude?
It's not really that catchy, is it?
Technically, they only call him Dude in it, so I don't see why not.
Man, I've got certain information, all right? Certain things have come to light, and, you know, has it ever occurred to you that instead of, running around blaming me, you know, given the nature of all this new shit, you know, this could be a lot more complex. I mean, it's not just, it might not be just such a simple, you know?
What in God's holy name are you blathering about?
Where's the money, Lebowski? And we're back, having watched The Big Lebowski. And we're not alone, as we have a special guest joining us to talk about The Big Lebowski. I'd like to welcome film blogger Sam. Hello.
Hello. Thanks, guys, for inviting me onto the podcast. I have listened to a bunch of your episodes on Spotify on my drive commute to work, so... It's nice to put faces to the voices that I've heard on a regular basis. So this is going to be good. I'm very excited to talk about The Big Lebowski.
Yeah, as are we. Well, I don't know about maybe not Sophie. I'm not too sure, but we'll get into that in a sec. But before we get into things, obviously, I'd like to get an insight into what you do as a movie reviewer.
Yeah, so I'm quite a passionate film watcher, film collector. Probably see on the video of us talking behind me.
Yeah,
lots of other shelves over there. Yeah, film is like my main passion in life. So I love to talk about film and particularly physical media on YouTube. I have a couple of podcasts myself, one of which is called Let's Watch 2, which is like a double feature podcast, which is sort of in hiatus. I do occasionally dip in and out of that one. And then I've just launched a new one called Soft Focus Blu-ray Reviews, which is like short form reviews of Blu-rays, one Blu-ray each with a guest that I have onto the channel. It's usually around about 30 minutes long, and we just discuss the film and the special features and things like that. And it's just nice and quick to discuss. And yeah, so that's what I like to do in my spare time when I'm not working and spending time with family.
Yeah, no, I've really like been checking out your content over the past few years, and yeah, and it's really good, and that's why I wanted to have you as a guest, because I know you have, I have a collection myself, but probably not quite half as big as yours. And yeah, so like an opinion on something, a film like this, obviously when I reached out to you, like, what did you want to discuss? And I'm thinking, look, there's the whole treasure trove of films we could discuss, but this had been on the watch pile to cover for a while anyway. So I'm kind of, oh yes, Chris, this is a great opportunity to talk about this. So yes, so The Big Lebowski, 1998 film, and what is your history with the film itself?
It's a good question. So the first time I saw this film, didn't really like it that much, to be honest. I didn't understand the hype behind its cult status, because by the time I watched it, it was probably the mid-2000s, and it had developed like a cult following by then.
Yeah.
And I sort of watched it as I was really getting deep into films, and I was checking films off the list of like things I need to see that, you know, a lot of people revere or cult items in the film world. And I watched it and I thought it was a well-made film, but I didn't particularly find it very funny. And nothing was really, I latched onto very much. Mm-hmm. Then a few years go by, and for some reason I saw a bit of it on television on a channel when I was just surfing. through the channels, and I was like, oh yeah, I've seen this film, and it was on. I was like, that bit's quite funny, actually. I mean, maybe I'll revisit it, because my film taste had developed.
Sure.
And I'd seen a lot more films, because we'll probably get into it, but this film takes a lot of influences from various different genres of filmmaking. And I'd seen a lot more things and become a lot more worldly in the world of film and things I'd viewed. And I got it a lot more. And I still didn't love it on my second viewing, but I definitely appreciated it more. It wasn't maybe until like my third or fourth viewing that I began to fall in love with this film and really sort of became attached to the characters and really got the humor. So this is, for me, the film that definitely rewards rewatching. But then it's hard to sell a film to someone sometimes when it's like penned as a comedy. And if you're not laughing on your first watch, then has it achieved what it's supposed to do? But it's very subtle. And I don't think the comedy comes from gags per se. It comes from character development and character arcs and story and you becoming familiar with who they are. So that's where the rewatching comes in. Now, as my journey has come to, I've seen this film probably maybe the most film in my adult life. There were probably Disney films or something that I watched as a kid repeatedly more than this, but in my adult life, The Big Lebowski is probably the film I've seen the most. Sure. This is very much a comfort watch for me. I can just put it on. It's one of those films I can put on for like half an hour while I'm like doing other things, and then I'll just like leave it there and then not come back to it for like a few months or whatever, and just have it on in the background and things like that. But then there's other times I can just sit and watch it and be glued to it because I love it so much. I can pretty much quote this film from start to finish. But yeah, now it's like, I don't like to rank art because I think it's kind of useless at points, but it's fun at the same time. But this is probably my third favorite film of all time. So that's where I land with The Big Lebowski now, as opposed to when I first watched it, I didn't think it was very good.
Well, in a similar way, I can't remember exactly when I first saw the film, but it wasn't like I say, like, oh, this, that, like, I've heard the name like thrown around quite a lot and like a cult status type of thing, but I did find it amusing. But the first time I was like, I don't really get what's going on, really. This, like, it seems a bit all over the place, but I think that's kind of the point, really.
It is,
yeah. In a weird way, and it's kind of like just like subverting your expectations on things of how. I mean, there's a structure of sorts, but it's like not like a clear narrative, and there's not real clear conclusion of the film in a way, but that's kind of part of the charm. And I think there's probably something in the fact of, like, as certainly on this watch scene, I think it's probably more of a, because it's been a while since I'd seen rewatched the film for this, and I feel like it was more like a sort of social commentary on like American lifestyles at the time, I suppose, when people are more like chill, laid back, and something like that, I think. But so I took more from it this time, and obviously there were still humorous bits, don't get me wrong, but it's nothing that's really like that, oh yeah, that's so funny. But it's not meant to be that way, not like something, say, like for the mainstream, like Superbad, where it's just trying to make jokes here, there and everywhere.
No.
Like that. But yeah, it works in its own way. So
is this the second time you've seen this film, Paul?
No, I honestly don't know how many times I've seen it, but maybe four or five, let's say.
So there's obviously, from the sounds of things, from both of you, there's a rewatching value. This is my first time.
Yeah.
So this is all new. There was a little bit of the ending of what am I watched, and there's a cowboy at the end telling me a recap, and I'm like, is that it? And left a little bit confused, I guess. Of what the whole thing was. Am I intrigued? Yes. Do I want answers? 100%. And will it... I have not ruled out not wanting to watch it again. It wasn't like a bad experience where it's like, I'm never, ever watching that. Because there's some comedies which I absolutely hate and I despise them. And it's normally like your super bad ones where they are cringy and the humor's just awful. And I just can't watch it. Whereas... Mm-hmm. Is it a comedy? I don't think I laughed.
No, I can't say that you, in what I can remember, I don't think you did laugh.
I don't think I did laugh.
That was so funny. You might have maybe laughing at the fact that I was laughing at certain things, more like the, every time like Donnie was shut down basically for like speaking his mind.
You're out of your element, Donnie.
Yeah. And yeah, but other than that, I don't think you were like,
no.
So good.
I'm on a journey at the moment, and I think with you two, hopefully by the end of it, I might be convinced that I'll want to watch this again and understand what I've watched. Because there's a lot of it where I'm like, I like the dude, like he's a nice character. Yeah. Yeah, he's all right. He reminds me of Scooby.
Shaggy.
From Scooby-Doo.
Yeah, so like, laid back.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is there a lot of progression in it for me? I'm not sure. I think I need to understand more, like everything.
I think that's where you might lose yourself watching it, because there isn't, the plot is, as Paul said, it's not meant to make sense at all. The Coens have come out and said this, the plot is superfluous. It's all about the characters, and what happens to them is really only a means to an end for them to get from A to B.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas how that happens is not overly important, because it is confusing. Like, and I've seen it so many times, I'm like, how does this make sense? Mm. Oh, it doesn't. It's not meant to. You're meant to like take in the vibe of the characters, which can be, again, it's a hard sell sometimes when you're being sold, oh, this is like a comedy. It's like a film noir. Yeah. I don't know how much experience you have watching film noir films, but it's got that sort of hard-boiled detective feel to it from like a 50s paperback novel.
Mm.
It is actually based on like Raymond Chandler. He's a writer from the 50s.
Right.
It's sort of like based on his style of books, and they would often like have really complex plots that were hard to follow, and you're like, well, how did that make any sense? And it's more of what's happening to the character in the moment. It's more of the point. But that's a hard state of mind to get into sometimes, and it certainly was hard for me, and as it took me maybe 4 or 5 watches for me to actually get to grips with this film. But yeah, so I get what you're saying when you're like, I want answers, or I want this to make sense, and do I need to watch it several times for the plot to make any sense whatsoever? And you're not gonna probably get there on 10 watches, because I don't think that's the idea of the film. So you will understand some more of the through lines and stuff on rewatches if you choose to, but overall general cohesion, it's not there, and it's made that way on purpose. So yeah, that's what I have to say about that.
Yeah, it's a very much, like I say, you said it, like a character driven movie, really. You kind of just even these characters that you only see for like maybe what 2 minutes or something, you know, and then they're gone, and that's that. It's just like, oh, it's like a comedy sketch bit thing, like with that what's it called, Jesus,
yeah,
the bowler at the bowling alley
with the Spanish rendition of Hotel California,
yeah
playing in the background.
Yeah, exactly. And what's it, Knox Harrington, the other, like the Scouse,
yeah,
David Thewlis character, who's just there for like
David Thewlis,
yeah, just
yeah,
doing that weird laugh and things like that.
He was brought in like last moment, because the scene, the Coen brothers thought that the scene was like too heavy on exposition and sort of brought the film down into too much without the surreality that the rest of the film has. So they just brought David Thewlis in to just literally sit on a couch, flipping through a book and just chuckle,
yeah,
just to add some levity to the exposition in that scene. And that's all he's literally there for. But I think it's hilarious when him and Maud are just cackling when they're on the phone, you know, it gets me, but because I've seen it so many times, I know exactly how they're laughing in my head, because I've seen this film 50 times. <so.
laughs> I get it. Yeah. I think a lot of the humor though does come from Walter, really, you know, when it almost like, as especially as the film goes on, he's sort of like level of anger as he progresses, just has those moments, doesn't he? And he's just like just over the top with what he comes out with,
like really chewing a person's ear off. Yeah.
Yep. Good moment.
And that was it. Yeah. You see what happens when you fuck a stranger in the ass. In this.
Yeah. Top 10 quote of the film, I think, that one.
Yeah.
When I watched that, though, I already knew at this point that car was not that boy's, and somebody else was going to come out and be like, what the hell are you doing to my car? Yeah. You already could see that coming from a mile off.
Yeah, I don't understand how that got confused, because obviously that kid is like 12 or 13 years old. I'm like, how is he right? No, but it's just bizarre. And that's the point. That's why I love it. And it's just the guy in the iron lung, and they're just like, oh, we're big fans of your work, but we've come to shake down your son, because it's just great. I love it.
And all that time as well, like the mother is like, she didn't like question like, oh, what's going on? Like, why are you going to smash the car up and everything? Or even like when you
no, yeah, she didn't come out or do anything.
Something like that, like why not? Kind of, it's like so just it's bizarre, but it's just the fact that there's a guy in like just let's say an iron lung in the background, and like it's like okay.
What's that? My favorite bit of that whole sequence is when it ends and they're all driving down the like the road, and they've got no windscreen, and they're just like Donnie's eating a burger in the back, and the dude's just got this look on his face driving the car. It's just genius, in my opinion. I just love it. It just makes the whole thing perfect.
Yeah, the fact that the car's still drivable at that point as well, because it goes through a lot, and obviously a lot of the dude's stuff, you know, his rug, for example, he's really threw the room together, and you know.
Well, he is a minimalist man anyways. He doesn't want a lot in life. And I think certain prized possessions like a rug and his car are mainly his materialistic kind of vibe, which is just only to get him from A to B and have a little bit of comfort. He doesn't have a lot in his house. And obviously when we kind of get to meet him initially, you see that somebody's assuming that he's got loads of money, and you can tell by the actual house. Well, if he does have a lot of money, he really don't put it into his home, because otherwise you would have loads of stuff in there.
Yeah.
And I think that's the level of like the people chasing after the money, you kind of baddies, so to speak.
Yeah.
I think the humour comes from them a little bit, because they're not very smart with actually figuring out, oh, well, actually, maybe he doesn't have a lot of money and we've got the wrong guy here. So can I dive in? We've got Jeff, who is the dude. Right? Yep.
Yep.
Okay. We've got an actual man, a rich man called Big, well,
he's the Big Lebowski, yeah.
And he's got loads of money, but apparently he doesn't have loads of money according to his daughter, and it's all in the trust fund.
No, he doesn't. He stole it all.
To fund his wife?
To bail, to get the ransom money. So he takes all the money out of the Little Lebowski Urban Achievers Fund to use it as ransom money for the to free his trophy wife
Bunny.
So his dead wife, who is Maud's mum, passed away, and then he's inherited all this money, but it's all tied up in the funds and stuff. So he actually doesn't have anything to show. It's like his house is all for show, because it's just been left to him. He doesn't have any of his own money. He's just basically no better off than the Little Lebowski in when it comes down to it at the end. He's just exactly the same. He's just pretending to be something he's not, but he's definitely not pretending to be in a wheelchair.
Do you know, I actually really thought that was the time that he'd got it right. Like, literally, I was thinking he's going to be able to stand up, he's not being over dramatic, he is putting it on, but it doesn't happen that way.
Well, he even says that. I've never been so sure in my life. And then, yeah, it's proven wrong. And like, what's it, Philip Seymour Hoffman's character, Brandt, who's kind of just there. And he kind of just goes along with the fact that they just call him dude and everything. It's like the way he says it as well. Like, sincere. It's, you know, like,
yep,
you're addressing someone as like sir or whatever.
Philip Seymour Hoffman is like my favorite actor of all time. It's not a very popular opinion, but I'm not sure a lot of people like his work. He's legitimately my favorite actor, and I just love him in this role. His laughter and his awkwardness, and just even to some of the poses he makes, like when they go into the room to reveal that Bunny has been kidnapped, and they show him the ransom note, and he's just like standing like a soldier at attention, and his arms are like down by his side, like really rigid. It cracks me up every time. But again, on the first few viewings, I didn't pick up on some of these little nuances and stuff. And then you see it so many more times, and I just pick up on all these little things. Some of my favorite moments just like aren't even quotable moments in the film. So it's a bizarre relationship I have with this film.
I'm quite appreciating this, actually, to be fair, because I think even if it's certain things where you're mentioning it, then it makes you want to go and actually rewatch it, because it's like, I actually probably didn't value that character that much, and it's probably not noticed half as much, just because it's like, I went in thinking I'm trying to understand what I've watched. Mm-hmm. And like you're saying, it's never going to actually happen. But initially, I did not know this.
No.
So it's one of those things where it's like, now I'd want to rewatch it just for not having to understand it, Like, the whole bowling thing, like, that was one thing that I was like, why are we so fixated on this bowling alley? And what is this about? And do we even get to the point of knowing if they win the tournament? I don't even think we do.
No,
we don't, do we? No.
So the actual, the character of Lebowski, Jeff Lebowski, you know, played by Jeff Bridges, he is based on a real person called Jeff Dowd, who the Coens met. And he was, like, an activist during, like, the Vietnam War and stuff like that. So when Lebowski is, like, had sex with Maud, and he's like, oh, yeah, I was in the Seattle 7. The Seattle 7 was a real organization that was, like, anti, like, Vietnam being in the government. And he's like, yeah, I was the Seattle 7 and six other guys, because, you know, it makes sense because there's seven of them. But it's because it's based, so it's a nod to the real Jeff Dowd. And a lot of the characters in this film are actually based on real people. It's still fictional, but it's, you know, taken a lot from reality and stuff. But the original concept was that Jeff Dowd was, like, super into baseball, but that just didn't work cinematically. And, like, and you'd have to get people to be able to, it just doesn't, I don't think it would work. And just the quaintness of the bowling alley just works so well for me. It keeps that,
it does that, yeah,
50s aesthetic that the film is, like, pulling from for the detective novels. So, you know, 50s America and stuff. It's like big bowling culture. And it just, even though baseball is, like, huge in America, it still has that, I don't know, that community-ness where you can just sit around in between your go on the lane and just have a few beers and just chat nonsense as the characters in the film do. So I like how they changed it from baseball to bowling. It just really worked, to the film's credit, in my opinion.
Yeah, the fact that they did that makes a bit more sense now. And as I say, like, for those characters as well who kind of just say just want to have a sit and chill in business. And so, like, say bowling, there's skill involved, sure, but obviously it's like you can just, again, just sit back and have a drink while you wait for your next turn and everything, and just chat the shit, really.
Yeah.
on things.
Yeah.
And some of the, like, I noticed this time that, well, or sort of more appreciation, should I say, the fact that there was, like, a camera shot, whereas as if you were inside the bowling ball as it was going.
Yeah.
And it did kind of make me feel like, ooh, a bit sick, really, because I'm not really good with motion sickness. But I really appreciated the shot that it was going for, to, like, and seeing all, it's almost like seeing how the bowling pins get stacked and everything. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a clever way of just showing us how ingrained they are in the culture of the bowling, really, because it's like part of their life, a big part of their life, essentially, because they spend a lot of time there.
Yeah,
that's what they strive to do, really.
Yeah, I love the dream sequences, like with the big choreography things, because that's like based on Busby Berkeley. I don't know if you're familiar with that filmmaker. Made loads of, like, big, like, musical productions in, like, the 1930s in America. You may be familiar with it. They used a lot of, like, bird's eye view looking down on the action, and it's all, like, choreographed, almost like synchronized swimming, but, like,
okay,
do you know, yeah, what, yeah, do you know what sort of thing I'm on about?
Yeah,
that,
yeah,
sort,
yeah,
of, like, big stage productions, like hundreds of people on a set and stuff, and it's sort of meant to be like an ode to that sort of thing. So I really love that nod and stuff. It's like, but the first time I saw that, even probably by the third, fourth time I saw that, I didn't know that it was a reference to those films, but then I've subsequently seen some of those films from the 30s, and now when I watch it, I'm like, oh, I can see what they're referencing here, and it just adds another layer to everything.
I remember when I first saw that kind of scene come on, I said to Paul, I was like, have I missed something? Because obviously we get to a point, is it like a dream sequence where he's been knocked out and then you kind of in this, like, dance musical?
Oh, you mean when it's like the fake porno?
Yeah,
and I was like, that, I, yeah, don't understand. Like, okay, he's been knocked out, so I'm thinking, oh, well, if it's like a Looney Tunes, he's seeing like little birds around his head or something. And then it's like a dream sequence where it's like, well, okay.
Yeah.
It's not actually an unpleasant thing. If you'd been knocked out, in my head, I think you'd be thinking, oh, well, somebody's after me. And I'd be thinking worse scenarios. But maybe he's a little bit drugged up at this point anyways. That.
Yeah, he's almost constantly high. So, or drunk on white Russians.
Don't blame me.
Which I've never had before, but I'm not sure I'd like to try one at some point.
Oh, you have to. They're my favourite. That's the only thing me and Jeff have in common, I think, because we both love a white Russian.
They are really nice, yeah.
I have to try one.
They don't look as, when I've tried to make them, they don't look as good as what he does, but...
he's got it down to a pat.
Yeah, he's been going for a while with them. The fact that he... keeps that milk on the side, though, isn't it like a refrigerator?
I know, you have to keep sniffing. Yeah. He keeps sniffing it to make sure it's okay.
But I guess it goes through quite quickly to, you know, the amount that he has. He's always constantly, when he's, you know, when he gets a moment, just at his little cocktail bar, just making something for himself.
Yeah.
What a life.
At Maud's house and at the Jackie Treehorn's house, his own house, like wherever he is, he seems to be reaching for the liquor cabinet, which is, you know.
Yeah, pretty much. Literally, that's all it is. It's either, but then he, I don't know, he's a weird character for me because he clearly doesn't have a job. He's not got any kind of, like, I don't think he's got any real true ambition to want to be anything else than he actually is. And I normally love a character that has growth, but then he's got really good, strong morals. And you can see that he's actually wants to do right. Even though he wants a laid back, chilled, relaxed life, he still wants to do good by Bunny, even though it's all a hoax and it's not anything out of it. And bless him, he's just been dragged into this whole load of crap for no reason.
Yeah, against his will almost. It's a bit like a bit of an annoyance for him. And he's, oh, this is coming to my life and now I've got to deal with this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you value that he cares. Like, that's something that you do value in him, even though you think he wouldn't, because it's like, well, I want a really peaceful life. I just want none of this to be in my life at all. And you can tell, like, the annoyance is becoming more and more apparent in him, even though he's a chilled, relaxed character. You can see that it's getting to a point where he's kind of getting annoyed with his friend.
Yeah, Walter, yeah. He's really just like against, he's always bringing up like his time as a veteran of, being a veteran of the Vietnam.
Yeah, it's so like, funny. And obviously you knowing that the dude is based on a character who was like anti, you know, America being in Vietnam in the first place, and like, how, why are these people friends in the first place? Yeah. You know, it's it's like they don't seem like they go together, and they kind of don't, but like the funny scene at the end when they scatter Donnie's ashes out of the Folgers coffee can and it just all goes back in his face and he's just like, just had enough with him, but then they just hug it out and they just go bowling. It's just
it's back just to normality. Yeah.
I think that definitely works with a man, like both guys being friends. I feel like if that was a woman scenario, I think that would pan out a bit different. I feel like women are a little bit more stubborn in the sense that we would hold a grudge a little bit longer, where guys could just be like, right, pat each other on the back, we're fine now, we're over it.
Yeah, I think there's some truth to that.
Not slagging any women off, because normally I'm really, really good at like empowering women here. But, you know, I've just brought this right down, haven't I? But can we speak about, I'm going to want to call him Mr. Pink, but Steve Buscemi. Is he Don?
Donnie, yeah.
Donnie.
Yeah.
So, hardly any lines, really.
Mm-hmm.
Gets interrupted all the time.
Yep.
He's the third wheel in a friendship. Like, it's the worst situation because neither one, you're just there. No one really prefers you. They've already got two best friends and he just tags along. But then when he's no longer there, you see that emptiness of what he brought, which is strange because initially when I was watching it, I was like, why is he even here? Like, why is he taking this part?
Yeah, especially because a couple of years prior, he'd like starred in Fargo, like the other Coen brothers movie, and he was like a big part in it, completely different character. Like, he's a very good actor, Steve Buscemi, but he's like, he takes this basically this role that has like a couple of lines of dialogue and doesn't do anything, but like his role is so important, I find, because when he's not there, you do miss him, and you're like, he's great for the comedy when Walter's like just tearing him down all the time. You feel sorry for him, but it's like funny the way that he does it. And then it, you know, it turns out that Walter did love him all along. But it's just bizarre.
But the fact that it was just kind of sudden how he dies, like, I just had a heart attack. It wasn't even like he wasn't stabbed or anything. Because initially, I think the first time I saw it,
I know.
There was no gunshots, and I thought he might have been stabbed, but no, he just died from a heart attack. And so, oh.
It's like the shock of it all.
And he's got no family.
Yeah.
And it's just sad. It's just poor Donnie. He's got no family. And
yeah.
He's gone.
And then he's put in a coffee tin, basically.
Because it's too expensive to pay for an urn. Which I kind of get if you think it's a bit expensive.
Yeah, it's like $200.
Yeah.
It's like, that's our most modest receptacle. It's just like, no. I can't remember. He says, is there a Ralph's around here? And I'm assuming that's like a convenience store in America.
It must be,
He's just gone and got to get a coffee tin. And he probably tipped it out on the street and then asked for the remains to be chucked into that. It's just genius. I love it. Yeah, it's true. You're like, well, we're just going to scatter the ashes. So we're going to pay $200 to transport this to the coast and chuck it in. And what are we going to do with this when it's done? We can't donate it. Who's going to want it?
It's so true. I think for me, I when I was watching it, I was thinking it was going to go two different ways. So I felt like maybe he's the quiet guy, but he has loads of money or something, and they were going to be inheriting something of his. And that's what they were looking at the piece of paper, because initially he's like, what's this? So I was thinking, oh, maybe they're getting quite a lot of money, and then that's how they're going to pay the Big Lebowski back or something and have that fund.
Yeah, they'll be rich from it, yeah. Yeah. Themselves. Yeah.
But sadly, no, that's not, it's not the case.
It is not. Oh, yeah. So much I like about this film. The cinematography is very subtly brilliant, in my opinion. I mean, it's photographed by...
Is it Roger Deakins?
Roger Deakins, yeah. Who's like maybe the greatest living director of photography.
Yeah.
You know, he's done so many great things. Like recently, Blade Runner 2049, which is like one of my favourite films recently.
Yeah.
Looks absolutely stunning. Yeah. I mean, he's got a whole filmography of amazing stuff, but he brought so much to this. It just looks great, but it's in a really subtle way. And again, on rewatches, you pick up on more of the choices and stuff, and like there's so many cool things of like the subconscious being used. For instance, in Maud's apartment, there is a picture of a pair of scissors on the wall with red handles on them.
Yeah,
you wouldn't, might not have noticed this because it's your first time watching it, I don't know. But then in the dream sequence, when he has the German music artist chasing after him with scissors,
yeah,
they're scissors, dressed in red, yeah, and they're chasing after him with scissors. So it's like a subconscious thing of something he's seen on her wall, going into his dream, and it's really, really cool. And there's other moments like that where it's like transferred over and like calls back to previous moments in the film. So it's sort of like multi-layered, and again, even on two or three times watching through, some of these things you don't pick up on, particularly if you don't watch them quick enough. Like sometimes you're not going to want to watch things for a few years usually.
Yeah.
But like me, I sometimes when I really got into this, there would be times where I'd watch it like the next day. So I'd like really pick up on some of the nuances and the really subtle things that the Coens had put into this, because they're really particular filmmakers. They know exactly what they're doing, and nothing is by accident. So you'll pick up things on that if you choose to watch this in the future. There are like loads of YouTube videos where you can go hidden Easter eggs and stuff on the Big Lebowski, and you'll look out for them the next time you watch it. All the like hidden meanings and references to different things.
In a way, I think I don't know if you agree with this, Sam, but in a way, it feels a kind of like Pulp Fiction esque with how the story goes in a little bit in some aspects.
Yeah.
But obviously not with the cutting between the pack, you know, certain the time frame and stuff. But I feel like just the sort of, maybe it's because it's sort of like an LA style kind of thing, and it's kind of like coasting along with the sort of the stories that we've got going with the characters.
I know Pulp Fiction, I think I fell in love with that a lot quicker, to be fair. But I think that was probably the storyline, and it was so back and forth that you had to really focus to. For me anyways, to actually be like really appreciate it. And I think for this, because it has such a chilled vibe, I've probably missed several things that, like, only when Sam said about the scissors, I'm like, oh yeah, I saw them scissors, and I clearly saw it in the dream sequence. Did I put them two together? No,
I didn't put them together. I haven't seen that. I must have missed that, like looking back off when I rewatch this again, see if there's the scissors on the picture on the wall.
Like, I know that picture's there. Yeah. I've seen that picture. Yeah. I'm aware of it, but did I piece them together like a puzzle? Not one bit. And I think that's what I'm guessing from this is why Sam probably really appreciates this film, is because actually you can unpick it. And it's not just on a surface level. I think when you watch it the first time, your value is it's not that funny. You've got three characters that they're okay personality and you kind of gel with. And basically it's just a rich person being held hostage, but she's not.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much like the surface level.
Yeah.
And I think that's when, if you don't actually delve into it and go back, you could be missing something like within the film. Because now that we're on about it all in a nutshell, it does make you think, well, actually, Jeff's character, he only wants to have a nice, relaxing life, but actually, maybe that's a good value to have in a person. And maybe all of us actually should take a little bit of Jeff and have white Russians every day.
That'd be nice.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe we should adopt some of the dude's, you know, outlook on life. Maybe not all of it. I don't, you know, just smoking a joint, laying on a rug, listening to bowling tapes. I don't know what sort of relaxation that brings someone. I don't know, but he seems to be having a whale of a time just imagining the strikes that are being made in the bowling alley through the recordings. So bizarre. But yeah, I totally get that. I think that's where the narrator comes in, where at the end when he's just like, you know, more people could probably take a leaf out of the dude's book and just chill a bit and not take things so seriously, but maybe not take it as laid back as the dude, because that's not going to get anyone anywhere quick and may end up in a situation like the dude in the future. Who knows? But yeah.
Isn't there, am I right in saying there's like a religion based off the dude? Like dudism or something? Or something like that?
Yeah, so in America they have like annual conventions where they all dress up as the dude and
well, celebration
and
of
just go and celebrate everything that is the Big Lebowski. It's quite mad.
Only in America.
I mean, only in America. I'm sure, I wouldn't put it past anywhere else to put on something like that. But I mean, I love the film dearly, but I don't think I'd go that far to... I think it's that sort of thing is very like grounded in like stoner culture, if you probably can imagine, which I'm not part of, but I still can appreciate the aesthetic of it and just the chill out vibes that the film gives me personally. So I get where they're coming from. And I can imagine a lot of people identify with the dude and just their general laid back view of the world and just how they go about their daily lives. You know, it's less amount of stress as possible and just do the few things that you love that make you happy, and just everything else is just background noise.
Yeah, I think everyone would have such more a peaceful life if they actually thought that way. And obviously, Donnie. Yeah. Donnie. But clearly he had got too much stress in his life, and that's why he had his heart attack, isn't it? Basically. So
in a way that, yeah, maybe it's something, yeah, parallel to that, isn't it?
Yeah.
Could be.
But then it is the dude's fault really taking on this mission, and you could have think that maybe he did kill his friend because he got him. But then is it actually more Walt's fault because he messed it all up?
The nihilist's fault, really, because, you know, they were, it's not fair, we want the money, so Lebowski, and it's like, yeah. It's like, yeah, well, life's not fair, so, you know.
And they just ask, like, yeah, well, just give us what you've got on you. And it's like, yeah, I've got, like, $8. Like, you wanted $1 million, and now you're settling for $8? It's so funny.
Also, the weasel in the bath. That, for me, I was like, I don't know, because the dude was obviously naked in the bath, and you've got some fragile parts, and there's a weasel with teeth, and I'm like, oh, where's this going to go? Is it going to be, like, that cringe comedy that I hate? Thankfully it wasn't, and it actually did have a bit of, I could see you being a bit in the corner if that situation was for you, you'd be hating it.
I love that scene. It's when he goes nice marmot and this just cracks me up. It's just so funny because they're putting on these ridiculously over the top German accents and it's just preposterous and just perfect. I love it.
I think it's the way he reacts to everything in life. Because, like, if that was me, I'd probably have overreacted about that. Like, if you were in that bathtub and you had...
Yeah,
you would. Like, you'd be screaming, wouldn't you? And be trying to fling it out or jump out of the bath. And he's just laid there kind of splashing it. And I think that shows the level of
commitment
his...
of doing it. It's like, yes, don't want to put too much effort into this. In a sense.
And he just stays in the bath after they leave. He just like just gets back to what he was doing. Wow.
What an ordeal. Yeah.
I know. What an ordeal. Right, I better just relax in the bath now and get over what I've just the trauma that's just occurred. This is when he's having his head put down the toilet right at the beginning of the film, and he's like, "Where's the money, Lebowski?" And he's just like getting dunked, and then he's like, "Oh, wait a minute! If you put me down there one more time, I might find it. Maybe it's there. I'll keep looking. Yeah. Maybe it's down there. Yeah, it's just so good."
And then he just sits on the toilet after the fact as well. He just sat there like, right, okay, that happened. There is another bit where he's trying to protect himself. You can see a little bit of defensiveness that's coming in, where he puts the chair the wrong way to block the door being opened.
Oh, good.
Yeah, and this is the wrong and way. And the door still opens because the door opens the other way.
I think I did actually laugh at that because I have done this before when we lived in an old house and there were some burglars going around. But I did it the right way so that literally the handle wouldn't go down. So I related to that. But the slab of wood with the little nails in, like, if anything, they're going to use that as a weapon for you, mate. They're not going to be, like, tripping over it.
Well, he trips over it later, doesn't he?
He trips over it, though. That's yeah. the thing. Yeah. And it's so just comedy. Just laying a gag for later. Mm-hmm. So it's like a double-sided gag where he's, like, done it wrong in the first place and then he trips over it later. It's just perfect.
And one of the bits are, like, was when he's at, was it, he's Draki Cherry Horns where he has, obviously, the drink spiked, isn't it? Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And he's like, oh, yeah, I've got a, he's on the phone and he looks like he's scribbling something down on the paper and about like a noir style thing's like, oh, I'm going to rub out over the paper and see what he's done to the message because this might be some information I need. And it's like, he's just drawing like a guy with a big dick or something on the thing. It's like, slows down. It's like, oh, okay.
Yeah. And then he rips it off and like scrunch it up, put it in his yeah, pocket. Yeah. And he's just like, what?
And that's where he's actually showing a bit of intellect and actually showing like he's trying to suss it out and work it out himself. Mm-hmm. And then bless him, it kind of backfires on him.
Yeah, he's like a reluctant detective, isn't he? He doesn't quite, he didn't want to do it and he still doesn't want to do it, but he's just like doing it out of the kindness of his heart because it's the kind of guy he is.
Yeah, he's invested in, like, obviously thinking Bunny has been kidnapped or held ransom and he's a good person and would want to help somebody, but he doesn't want it to overburden his life. Mm-hmm. It's like the relationship he's got with, when he says, is it my baby mama? What's the word he uses when that reporter...
Oh,
have I written it down?
What's it now? My special lady or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't know, there's some kind of sweet endearingness about it, even though he's obviously sleeping with her and she wants to have a baby and she doesn't want anything to do with him afterwards. And he's fine with that because, like, I think the commitment of being tied down isn't really his ordeal. But he doesn't want anyone to mess with her either. And he kind of protected over her, even though he doesn't want anything serious from it. And you can kind of...
Yes, he's got morals there. Isn't
yeah, he does have morals, but in a weird about way, but you kind of respect them.
Julianne Moore's character is also based on a real person. What's her name? She's an artist. Caroline something. But she, like, in the film, she swings naked from like a trapeze thing or whatever and like just splatters paint everywhere and it's just like, what is this nonsense? That's based on a real person. I can't remember her name. I should really know because, you know, me saying this is like one of my favorite films, but she's based on an artist called Caroline someone who actually did that. She worked with like Yoko Ono and things like that back in the day, and so it's like, again, pulling from real people and people that the Coen brothers either knew of or just like found interesting and wanted to pull some of their personality into the film. So, you know, Maud is actually, you know, part real and fiction. So it's quite interesting.
To be fair, when I first saw Maud flying in on like the whatever you want to zip line.
Yeah.
I thought she was going to attack him. Like literally that's what
she had knives in her hand or something.
Yeah. Literally that's how I felt. And I was like, oh, he's gonna get hurt here. Because everyone's been out to get him at this point. And then it's like paint and she's like this artist and you've got this whole new character that undevelops. But initially, like the music's quite daunting when you first kind of get to see her. So I just feel like she's going to be a bad person again, like trying to get after the money. But it's quite a different case.
She's quite free in a different way as opposed to the dude.
Yeah, if you think about it, there is a lot of similarities between the two of them. They just live in very different worlds. You know, she's extremely liberal and free and like strong independent woman. He's maybe not, he's independent but not successful, but you know, can't measure a person's worth based on their success. So, you know, he has this just laid back attitude and is still very free and liberal as well. So it's just like two sides of the same coin where she just represents a different side of that sort of freeness where she's successful and arty and driven. When he's just like not, but still very much in the same vein, I think.
And you always say opposites attract. And that's probably why she likes him, because he isn't anything exactly like her, because he doesn't have the wealth and he's still got the same morals as her. So it shows like they do. Yeah.
That connection. Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting. It really is.
I'm glad you found it a bit more like thought-provoking now that you've had the conversation about it. Like, I'm not saying it's going to like encourage you to like rush out and like sit down and watch it immediately after this, but like maybe in a few years time when you're thinking about, oh, maybe we can put something on, and you'll go, you know what? Yeah. Oh, remember that conversation we had with Sam on the podcast about The Big Lebowski? Or maybe if we rewatch it this time, I'll find something different to see in it this time. I hope you do that, because I think you will find something. You may not love it again on the second viewing, because again, I didn't. You know, I'm not trying to say your second viewing, it's going to snap into place and you're going to absolutely love this film and vibe with it. It may, and that would be great, but it may take a few more. But then in 10 years time, you may watch it again and go, oh, this is, I understand what Sam's opinion is on this now. I get it. Or you may never like vibe with it like I do, because, you know, all art's subjective and stuff.
Just the way that Sam talks about this makes me want to rewatch it, to be fair. It really does. And I think I always love that about talking to somebody else about a film, that if you don't understand
that, that they're passionate about as well.
Yeah. It really helps, because I think it's one of those things where I went into this thinking, I don't really know what I've seen. I don't really know what I've watched. I don't feel like I valued it enough when I did watch it, because it was like, I'm not really sure. But now talking about it and unpicking pieces, like Jeff initially, I don't think I really thought he'd grown as a character. But now actually looking at it, he has had a little bit of development within it, even if it's not a lot, like he's not like a big successful man or anything like that, but he cares. And I think that's showing like the morals within in himself. Like initially he just wants a good time and wants to defend himself. But now actually he's got people in his life that matter. And I think that's actually the best thing about it, really.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, no, definitely not maybe... You know me, I have to wait a bit of a while, don't I, to watch a film. But I definitely would watch it again.
Yeah. Awesome. Good news.
Well, with that being said then, is there anything else you want to talk about before going to scores?
I don't think so. I think we've covered most of the key points. And my main takeaway is that Sophie is open to the idea of watching this film again one day. Who knows how long that'll be, but like I'm because you were like, oh, wasn't really into it, didn't really find it funny, wasn't sure what I watched. And now you're like, you know what, after hearing Sam talk about this, I'm keen to watch this again at some point in the future. And I'm like, yep, yeah, that's awesome, I've done my job. Oh,
definitely.
Do you want me to go first on scores, or do you want to go first?
We always throw his guests under the bus.
Yeah.
Just that's fine.
But yeah, no,
but I think, well,
I've got
a hunch, maybe, if what this might your score might be.
If you just score it out of 10.
Yeah, it would be a 10. It's like contender for my favourite film of all time. So, but let's go back a little bit, just not to go off the beaten path too much. But like my first viewing, I would probably have rated this like a 5 or a 6 out of 10. Oh, okay. And now it's like, in my opinion, a perfect movie. So, you know. It just goes That's to show really you can't always base your thoughts and feelings and experiences with movies, particularly. Same with music as well.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes music takes a time to grow on you, but music's a lot easier to digest because a song can be 4 minutes long.
Yeah.
And if you don't like it the first time, you're like, oh, it's all right. But then sometimes you listen to it 10 times and you're like, oh my God, I love this track. Movies are a bit harder, especially when it's a 2-hour noir comedy. You know, it's not something you can just throw on and just digest easily. So, but yeah, 10 out of 10 now. Well, I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on how you rate this one.
We didn't do that last time. I jumped in for the when we
If you threw me off, I was like, I'm going. Okay, so we actually had a bit of a chat before, which we normally don't do, and we normally come on here and neither one of us know what we're going to score. And I was like, because of how I felt, I was like, what are you scoring this? Like, I don't actually know what to score. And Paul, like, kind of looked at me a little bit like, not really wanting to tell me. So he went, so what do you think? So kind of prying what I was going to score it. So it's not the worst film I've ever seen. Like, my first initial watch, it is not. Like, there was no cringe moments. I could enjoy it for what it was. Yes, it left me a bit confused, but... not in a point of where like the film just ends and you have to make up your own ending or anything like that. You did have like a narrator at the end tell you what happened. It, you know, it is pretty straightforward how it ends in your conclusion. And I think it's quite interesting actually, because I don't think I'm being as actually harsh as you're going to think. So I said to Paul, I'm going to score it a 7. And I feel like that's my...
Awesome.
I know, right? And this was before we even spoke. So I can't say it's one of those ones I can lowly score, because I feel like I, just because I didn't appreciate it and I couldn't actually see the value in it, doesn't mean that wasn't there and that I didn't enjoy the artisticness. Like some cinematography was absolutely stunning. Even like the colours and the hues of the tones of the bowling alley, like the way that they did things, I can appreciate that. And the acting in it, like they are really good at their job, what they're doing. It was more the story. I think that was a bit that I was lacking. And I think that's why it's not as high this time. Hmm. That doesn't mean there's no room for growth.
Yeah. Well, there we are.
That's so cool to hear. Like, you loved it more than I did on my first go round.
Yeah. So... You never know, it might become
you're
a 10.
Be a super fan on your next watch.
And for me, I'm going to put it at 9. Because there is a lot to enjoy. Because, like, I was thinking back to when we reviewed Fargo, and that was a long time ago, to be fair, like one of the earlier episodes we did. But that's good, don't get me wrong. But, like, for their, obviously, for this being their second film, and there's like a lot more different elements they're taking from all time for film genres and stuff. And this is a lot easier to get into and enjoy. And this, like I say, there's value in repeat watches from this, as you say, Sam. And so, and especially got a lot more from it this time with sort of like, I say, a critique of American society and things like that, that I wouldn't have necessarily picked up from, say, certainly not the first viewing, and maybe not even the second viewing. But still finding the humorous elements to it, especially that's still going to be there even from those early viewings. But there's so much to appreciate, especially like I say, the cinematography as well. That's something that as I've gotten older as well, come to appreciate.
You do. It's true. Some people sneer at that. Yeah. I'm like, oh, you're paying attention to the camera work? What? I'm like, no.
Yeah, you know.
Wait till you get older. Yeah. You'll start to notice these things when you become, you know, more familiar with film and stuff, and you pick up on things a lot more.
And also, I know we didn't really touch on the soundtrack as well, but I'm always big on, like, even not just necessarily like film scores, but I'm obviously like soundtrack, you know, just diegetic sound that's kind of just playing, like say on the radio in the bowling alley or whatever, that kind of stuff. I really appreciate it's all good stuff, really. Just again, chill music, but yeah.
I can't even tell you, apart from that one piece when that lady comes in with the paintbrushes, that's the only thing that stuck with me music-wise. I can't actually think of any other music.
What about the Eagles? You know, they suck.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. There's lots of Creedence Clearwater Revival in the film.
Yeah.
There's some cool tracks. Bob Dylan opens the film as well.
Oh, is that the Tumbleweed song, should we call it?
No. Right. What's that? The Man in Me is like plays over the opening credits. Tumbleweed is Sons of the Pioneers,
okay.
I think, is the artist. Yeah. I don't even know when they're from. Probably like the 30s or something like that. I don't know. That's probably an insult to the artist. I don't know when they're from. They probably are from that time. I don't know. But it sounds like from that era. So
yeah, that about does it. Thank you very much for having this conversation with us, Sam. It's been really insightful to...
Educational allergies.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Yeah, I mean, I just love chatting film with anyone and everyone. Yeah, and
same.
To be asked to talk about The Big Lebowski, which I've actually not done on like YouTube or in podcast form before, which is strange considering it's one of my favourites of all time. But there's never been an opportunity to talk about it. So, you know, thanks for bringing it up. And yeah, it's been great. You know, could go on and on, but... so many niche things I could talk about with the film, but I think we'll leave it there. And
and lastly, if you just would like to remind people where they can find you on the socials.
Yeah, sure. So you can find me on YouTube under Film Blogger Sam, and as I said, I just cover like film reviews and talk about physical media on Blu-ray and 4K and things like that. And then that's also where my podcasts are. They're also on Spotify, but I do video versions of them as well. And then I'm on Instagram, also under Film Blogger Sam, and I just post my recent pickups and things like that.
Well, thank you very much once again for joining us, Sam. Been a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
See ya.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode, and a big thank you to our special guest. If you want to check out some of our other episodes, you can do so by going to Apple Podcasts, Spotify,
Podbean, and wherever else you get your podcasts from. And we'd really appreciate you leave us a 5-star review on any of those platforms as well. A big thank you to the patrons for supporting the show, who are Mark from 100 Things You Learn from Film, Ben from Film Vloggers, Nico from the Good, the Bad, the Weird podcast, Chris Gren, who is cgren_draw on Instagram, Alex, who is Desperately Seeking Username on Instagram, Shani, who is SDOG on Instagram, Danny Jones, or Jonesy, who is @WeightLossJonesy on Instagram, Emma, who is m_Hayton on Instagram, and of course, Sophie's mom. And if you would like a shout out on each of our episodes and the opportunity to vote on what we watch once a month, all you have to do is go to patreon.com/spfilmviewers to sign up for as little as £1 or $1.50 a month, and gets you those little perks and helps grow our little community. And lastly, if you'd like to follow us on social media, you can find us on Instagram, Twitter, Threads, and TikTok under the handle SP_filmviewers. Once again, thank you very much for listening, and we will speak to you next time.